show tonight, and this is going to be a very interesting one. I really want you to listen in closely, and we're looking for volunteers tonight. You're going to be able to listen and hear and see everything about CASA. CASA. You're going to understand what that means in a moment. But imagine being a child with parents who can't or won't care for you. Into your life come dozens of strangers, police, foster parents, social services, social workers, judges, lawyers, and more. You need help, but where can you turn? Now imagine a trained, committed, court-appointed advocate who speaks up for you, stands by your side, argues for your best interest until the case is closed. That's what it means to be a CASA. It means making sure a child doesn't get lost in the overburdened legal and social service system, or language in an inappropriate group or foster home. It means the difference between homelessness and a safe home, between dropping out and completing school, between unemployment and success, between jail and becoming a productive member of society. Thanks to our volunteer advocates at CASA, they serve nearly 400 children. I'm going to introduce you to the executive director of CASA, and his name is Rush Ricard, and I've had four inquiries. Where's Rush Ricard come from? Well, he's the executive director of the Champaign County CASA for the last 6 years. Rush, welcome to our program.
Thanks. It's good to see you. Good to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here, and I want to thank you for coming. We're going to be discussing all things CASA tonight. But because my show is not a gotcha show, okay, yeah. My show is an informational and important educational show. Mm-hmm. Give me your background. First, you did explain off air, Rush Ricard.
Right.
Everybody thinks it's record,
right?
Of course.
Yeah.
But give us the background, where you came from, sure. Your family and everything, because it is a history.
Sure. My Rush is actually my middle name, so my first name is Robert, so I'm Robert Rush Ricard. Robert was my mother's father's name, and Rush was my dad's father's name. So Rush goes way back in the Ricard family. My mom is a Welsh, so I've got some German and Irish in me. But I grew up down in Mattoon. Went to Mattoon High School, Lakeland College, EIU. And in 1990, found my way to Champaign to become a probation officer for Champaign County. Did that for 13 years, ending with the intensive probation program. Left Champaign County after, as I said, 13 years to take a little bit of a break. Worked for a friend of mine for about a year, and then went back to work for the Unit 4 School District with the truancy program. So,
oh, I thought you were a member of the board.
No, I wasn't a member of the board.
That would have been something to remember.
My job was much easier, I think. I worked for Unit 4 for 3 or 4 years while I got my master's here at the U of I. And luckily, the last semester of my internship, the CASA position became available. And really, for me, with my prior background with Champaign County, working with kids, and then having my MSW, I threw my name in the hat and was lucky enough to be chosen to lead the CASA program. And here I am.
6 years later.
6 years later. Six quick years later.
Well, I'm afraid I look back and all the years have been quick. They seem to go.
They certainly don't slow down.
They don't slow down at all. Give me a background. The true name of CASA is?
Court-appointed special advocates.
Okay. And they are special.
Absolutely.
How many are there?
Right now there's about 90 from all walks of life, all backgrounds, all levels of experience.
Now, these ladies and gentlemen, they're not attorneys.
Correct.
They're volunteers.
They're volunteers.
But do they need any kind of special background or
they don't.
Education?
They don't. And actually, we've really found that it helps sometimes to just have very diverse backgrounds. We've got retired social workers. We've got retired teachers who've lived working with kids every single day. And then we've got folks who have never worked with kids. They know little to nothing about the social service area before they come to us. And, you know, we like to say that we give them all the tools through the training to become a CASA advocate. So you don't need any experience. We want you to have a desire to help kids. And that's what we're all about.
There are how many?
90.
90. And how many children are they?
We hover around 400 kids, which is about 240 cases. So you have many cases with multiple children in them.
So these 90 take care of 400 children?
Right.
400.
We, as you know, we're actually contracted by the county.
Right.
To be what's called the guardian ad litem for all of these kids. And that GAL is actually a fancy term for providing legal representation. So that's why our numbers are so high. If you were to compare CASA programs across the state, first of all, you wouldn't find another program that's actually contracted with their county to be the GAL. But you wouldn't also likely find a county with the numbers the way that we have in the area of having 90 advocates for 240 cases. Most CASA programs only serve the amount of kids that they have actual volunteers for. So of those 90, most of them are actually on a case, actually assigned to at least one, sometimes more than one. And then we have a group of advocates that do additional things for us that we need done, home visits, checking up on the kids that don't have a particular CASA advocate assigned to them.
How many volunteers are you looking for?
As many as we
can
get, to be honest. You know, class-wise, we actually, as I told you, we actually have a class starting February 16th. We'd love to have 20 to 25 people in a class. You know, we average 5 to 10, so we'd love to have a big push. Do we need a CASA for every single case? If I were to be honest with you, probably not. But we need far more than what we have right now.
You said that there's a training program starting.
Mm-hmm.
When does that take place?
February
and where?
16th.
Okay.
We will train at the Mills Breast Cancer Institute. Carl's very generous to us. They provide us training space at no cost.
Oh,
and we found it's worked very, very well. So February 16th is when we start. It goes for about 3.5 weeks, 3 nights a week, for 3 hours a night.
Okay, I have a quick question for
sure.
You here. Recent national events have brought the question to the forefront. What should people in authority do when they know that a child may have been hurt?
Well, the first thing they need to do is report it. And any time that I do any sort of presentations, I try to end my presentation by telling whatever group I'm talking to that if you see something, say something. One of the best examples I can give you is Jerry Sandusky at Penn State. That abuse occurred over many, many, many years. And it was a result of people not speaking up. And so, you know, it's somebody making a simple phone call many years before that was discovered. The situation may have been taken care of. So.
Now, those are people in authority. What about you and I? If I hear something in my neighborhood, I don't want to, you know, how do I know that I'm not causing a real problem for a family who are just disciplining their child? You know,
right.
You see them in a grocery store.
Yeah.
They smack a kid on the rear end. He's not doing something. He's 3 or 4, and you say, "Come on, you know, you don't hit a child." But I don't stop them and I report them.
Mm-hmm.
What's the basis for the actual report?
That's a great question. Anybody, literally, can make a phone call to DCF to the DCFS hotline, completely anonymous and completely confidential. And then they can take it from there. If you have specifics, that's what they need and they want. They will not tell, if they investigate the call, they will not tell the family who made the phone call. So you're not risking anything at that point. And again, you don't know if you make this phone call today, that might be the phone call that actually takes care of something that's been going on for months or years even. There may have been several calls prior to yours, and this was the one that made the investigation happen. So that's what I mean when I say, if you see something, say something. You can always call the police. They can determine whether they need to come out and investigate. But it's always best to make that phone call.
You know, I'm sure it's hard for people.
Mm-hmm.
Could someone be vindictive and want to cause problems for someone and make a phone call? Would that? I'm trying to be devil's advocate here because I want to make sure that the child is being protected,
right,
and it's not for some vindictive reason that they hate the family,
right?
You know, or they had some road rage or something,
yeah,
and now they want to get even. Have you ever had that kind of a situation?
Well, you know, I'm sure that the DCFS hotline has experienced something like that. I mean, the cases that CASA sees are the cases that have been investigated thoroughly and abuse and neglect is determined to to have happened and a petition is filed. But certainly there are cases where, you know, we hear it all the time. Kids get caught in the middle. They get caught in the middle of divorces. They get caught in the middle of many, many things. And sometimes I'm sure people, you know, unfortunately do try to put that child in the middle and get pulled other several different ways.
So a complaint is made. Mm-hmm. It goes to DC. Do they get all the complaints, or what if it goes like 911 to the police, or does it automatically go to them?
The most common way is calls to the DCFS hotline, and there are a group of individuals that are mandated reporters, medical personnel, schools, law enforcement, social workers, licensed social workers. There's a long list of people that are mandated reporters. And so I would say the most common way that a case comes into court is it's called to the DCFS hotline and investigated by the department. And what happens is when you're on the phone with DCFS, there's literally a master's level person on the other end in Springfield going down a checklist. And then they will determine whether they're going to refer that for investigation. An investigation is supposed to be initiated between 24 and 48 hours, and DCFS takes that investigation on. And so a lot of people think that maybe law enforcement is the one that investigates, and more often than not, it's DCFS. They may do it in conjunction with law enforcement, but they're usually the ones starting it. The other things that can happen is there can be a call to the police. One of the most common examples I give
is domestic abuse going on.
Yeah, there could be domestic abuse where, for instance, Champaign police would take protective custody of the children, and then they would turn them over to DCFS.
I see.
And then DCFS would investigate from that point. There can be, say, a drug raid, and the SWAT team goes in, they do their raid, they do their business, they discover that kids are present and there's drugs in the home. They will take protective custody, they will call a department. The department takes it from there.
Does that automatically bring you into the case, or how is it at the point of this child needs an advocate?
It does not automatically bring us into the case. I tell you that we have 400 kids in the system. I can tell you that I'm sure that there are hundreds more kids that are not in the court system, but maybe are being offered services by the department or somebody else. There's intact family cases is what they call them, where maybe they've investigated some things. And instead of bringing the kids to court and family to court, they're trying to fix it with everybody together and offering services that way. You know, some of these investigations are unfounded, where they get a call and they go out and say there's nothing here. We get the worst of the worst.
Do you work with the police? I mean, in cross purposes. You know, if that same child now here's my question.
Mm-hmm.
I want to try and phrase this properly.
Right.
The child is pulled out of the family.
Mm-hmm.
Where does he go? To DCSF?
Right.
And then what? Do they keep him? Or, as you said, you don't want to put him in a foster home if you can. So how does that process work to get to CASA?
That's also on the front end of DCFS's responsibility. So if right now there's a caseworker out investigating an abuse case, and they determine that they need to take protective custody, which is immediate, which means they're going to remove that child right now.
And they can just do that.
They can do that.
They have that authority.
They can do that. They have that authority. Then what they will do is they will literally take the child back to the office, and they will start trying to determine a location or a place for them to stay. Now, what they do is they first of all, if they can place with a relative, that's what they would prefer to do. The relative obviously has to be appropriate, has to be, you know, has to pass background checks and things like that. But that's what they would like to do. It's less traumatic for the child to be placed with somebody they know. But if there's not a relative available, they will actually start with a small circle of foster homes that will be maybe Champaign and Vermilion County. They will make phone calls. They will see if there's a place. And then that circle, if that doesn't work, that circle starts to get bigger. And so you start looking outside. You start looking maybe Macon, Piatt, Coles.
Really?
And the circle continues to get bigger until they find a placement. And so of those 400 kids that we have, about 25% of those kids don't live in Champaign County because they're placed outside of the county, yet the court retains jurisdiction.
Oh, I was just going to say, the Champaign County still retains the jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And your advocates, are they brought in for – court cases and court appearances into our county courthouse?
You know, that's one of the things that's kind of a little bit of a misunderstanding. The kids are rarely in court.
Really?
And that a lot of that is because there's a lot of things being discussed that
right.
really the kids probably don't need to hear. Now, some of the older kids, sure, they're going to come to court sometime.
We're talking teenagers?
Yeah. Maybe if we, you know, if they have a desire to talk to the judge personally, we can do that. But I would say more often than not, particularly the younger kids, are not in court. All their representatives are there. And one of our roles as CASA advocates is to tell the judge what the child wants. So our advocates have talked to the kids.
All right. So we're seeing you in the courtroom, you have your advocate.
Mm-hmm.
He's not an attorney. So the county, the state's attorney handles
right.
that case?
You have you will have the state's attorney. You will have the parents' representatives. That can it can be a public defender. It can be a private attorney.
Right.
It can be father's attorney and mother's attorney. Anybody that's a party to that case is entitled to legal representation. And then you will have a CASA attorney. And so it's
a CASA attorney.
A CASA attorney. So we have
I see.
Advocates and attorneys. And we have right now we have three attorneys that work with us. And do the legal side. So they do the legal representation for the kids. So
is that paid or pro bono?
Well, part of the county contract goes to what we pay them.
Right.
I've got one that is pro bono, completely pro bono. I've got two that are getting paid far less than what they're worth.
Right.
You know, we average over 100 court appearances a month.
Oh, wow. 100? Really?
Over 100 usually, yeah.
Is there any one judge who handles the children? Or?
Currently, Judge Olmstead and Judge Kennedy have the abuse and neglect call.
Does all the abuse mm-hmm. cases.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow, that's got to keep him busy.
Yeah.
I mean, 100 cases.
It's pretty busy.
I would think so.
Yeah.
So the care of the child
mm-hmm.
comes first.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And he's placed in this situation, and then the court decides permanent relief from the parents, or parents can get them back, or
right.
on probation, or what are the outcomes of some of the cases? And give us a few cases,
sure.
if you can. I would appreciate
well,
it.
Well, you're going to have, at the very beginning, in all of these cases, there's what's called a goal. And the goal is return home, the goal is adoption, the goal is independence, whatever is appropriate. We're going to start off in every case that the goal is return home, and that's a mandate to the Department of Children and Family Services through one of their consent decree. And so what I will say about abuse neglect court is that it's very, very deliberate, and it takes a long time for a conclusion to come to fruition. And really that's because the decisions that are being made are really very, very important decisions. And as sure, we want to be as sure as we can be. This is the line of work that's very difficult to really be sure about anything sometimes, because you don't necessarily know what the success is going to be. But you know, we hope that if we can reunify a family, we would love to do that. That's what's best for the kids. Unfortunately, there's cases where that just can't happen. And so maybe you're looking at an adoption. Maybe the child is put up for adoption, and another family adopts them. Sometimes the parents' rights need to be terminated, which is really one of the most ultimate rulings and decisions that can be made.
That's got to be serious.
And that's really serious, and it's very – the standard is extremely high to right. get to that point. You've got some kids that sometimes are older, and I'm talking 18 to 21 – that maybe services just aren't going to work, or they don't want them and they'd rather be out on their own, and sometimes that's what the conclusion is. So they really run the gamut, but the best stories are the ones where, you know, the kids get reunified with the families.
All right, before we go into that,
sure.
I'm going to stop you right
okay.
here, because we're listening. You're listening to Big Al's Community Chat on WEFT 90.1 FM on your radio dial and streaming live on WEFT.org. And our pledge drive is going to be coming up soon. So please hang in there for us and help us continue to do this great work here at WEFT after 36 years. We're speaking with Rush Record, And he is the executive director of CASA here, and he's going to give us some great, positive, hopefully, stories about the conclusion of what some of these cases can actually bring to a young person.
Yeah, Rush. One of my favorite stories, you know, obviously we can't talk specifics, but one of my favorite stories is we had a little girl who came into the system at a very young age.
Can you tell us what that age was?
Less than a year old.
Oh, less than a year.
And she was placed with foster parents, and it went very, very well. There was a very strong bond between them. And this was a pretty long case, but throughout the course of the case, there were some folks identified as possible placements for her. And as she got older, you know, she was able to really speak for herself and tell everybody what she really wanted. And it got to the point where, you know, CASA was the longest serving person on her case.
Really?
So we had the most knowledge that there was in the courtroom. And the ultimate decision for her was she was adopted by these foster parents. And she's thriving now. There's no problems. All of her services have been in place. And those are the best ones. And, you know, we also have the ones that, you know, in this business, if you do it long enough, you can get a little bit jaded and kind of feel like sometimes, you know, society may not do the right thing. And you get a case that comes in, you look at it on paper, and you're thinking, wow, you know, we don't know which way this one's going to go. And we had one of a young man who came in and was a little bit older, but could actually voice his opinion.
Seven, eight?
Older than that. Older than that.
And so he has been in this family for how long? 10,
Yeah, it had been a while. It had been quite a while.
And so was there abuse at all the different stages found out about it?
Right. And he came into us, and of course, at that age, you can tell us.
Sure.
You know, he can talk. And, and you know, from the very beginning, and I will tell you this, no matter what happens to these kids, they always want to go back home. I mean, if they're abused by mom and dad.
Right.
And, you know, kids are pretty resilient, and they look past that. And, you know, and that's the tough part about our business. Sometimes that's not the best thing for the child. But he kept verbalizing that. I want to go back home. And, you know, a lot of people in the case were just very reluctant, didn't know that it was going to happen or be successful. The parents did every single thing that they were asked to do.
There's a list of things that the court demands of the parents before they get the child back.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things I tell people sometimes, you know, as a former probation officer, I would always tell the kids I served, if you want to stay out of jail and stay out of trouble, all you've got to do is what's right here on the black and white. Judge has told you. Boom, boom, boom. And really, abuse and neglect isn't much different. There's an order entered, and the order says, mom and dad, this is what you got to do. You know, counseling, whatever's appropriate in whatever case. And these parents did it, and they did everything they were supposed to do. They were reunified. Everything's going well, and we haven't seen them again. And that's the ultimate for us, is that when you return kids home, reunify families, and you don't ever see them again, that's the best thing that can ever happen.
Do they check up on them after they go back to the family?
Mm-hmm.
Is it just over? Once a case is over,
it's over. And really that, honestly, that gets into the manpower issue. You know, once a case is closed, unfortunately, you move on to the next one. And that's from a statistical point of view, from organizations like ours and CASA, it's difficult to talk about what has happened after they've exited the program because we usually lose track of them. Yeah. You know, especially if you've got a child that their case closed out at 6 years old, you know, unless you're lucky enough to see them somewhere, you're likely not going to know what happened. But usually when a case is closed, it's closed.
You've been doing it for 6 years. Mm-hmm. How long has CASA been in Champaign?
We started in 1994.
Okay. So we're talking almost 20 years.
Yeah.
Do you ever get some of the kids coming back as adults and saying, thank you, CASA, for...
We do.
Tell us a little.
We do periodically.
Yeah, to me, I would think that's the most gratifying
of
all.
We had our 20th anniversary a year or so ago and kind of had a luncheon and kind of had... a lot of the folks back that started it, and we had read an article about a young lady up in the Chicago area who actually is going to law school and is a former CASA child. And Jack DeLamar, who was on the bench at the time Costa started, handled her case. And she reached out to him and wrote him a letter. And basically one of the things he said was, if it wasn't for Casa, law school wouldn't have been a possibility. Unfortunately, those are rare, but it makes us, it's really gratifying when you've got a good one. And I know there's many more out there. You just don't hear about it. You know, it takes a lot for a child or an adult to admit that they've been through the system. I mean, it takes a lot to be able to do that.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
I understand working with children. In my past, as county board chairman, mm-hmm. I was automatically the superintendent of Head Start, early Head Start, mm-hmm. and on the policy board. So, yeah, we had some very interesting and not always positive stories mm-hmm. about what went on in the classes.
Right.
And some of those might have ended up in CASA mm-hmm. because if a child shows signs of abuse mm-hmm. in the Head Start, early Head Start program, they're obliged to right. call in.
Right.
Get that taken right. care of as well. Right. So I was privy to some of those mm-hmm. stories as well as superintendent.
We also take great satisfaction, too, in the small victories. You know, when you advocate on an open case and you get a child's services sped up or a child maybe moved off a waiting list for a counseling session or assigned a counselor, you know, that's for us, those are small victories. And that really goes to the core of why we're around.
Just talking about education, do you have the inroads into – I know the schools are very private.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like to talk about mm-hmm. things that go on within the school
right.
system. But there's got to be a time when a teacher says, this child is – you know, even a teenager, you can see bruises. You can see
right.
Problems with the child, mm-hmm. and they report it to the principal.
Right.
He's obligated.
Right. They're mandated
to report. They're mandated to call mm-hmm. in to the police
Correct.
Department and then – Do you
Correct.
Work with the superintendent of schools?
We do, and that's the advantage of being a guardian, appointing the guardian ad litem, is because if we get a new case tomorrow, we are appointed day one on that case by court order, and that court order gives us access to school records, counseling
oh, really?
Records, really virtually everything that is comes through on the kids' cases. So we are very, very active in talking to schools. We're invited to all the meetings. If a child is a special ed child and has an IEP, an individualized education plan, we're invited to those meetings and have input. And then that's the advantage of being a guardian ad litem program. So we have access to virtually everything everybody else does. And really that's the best way for us to make the best recommendation we can to the court. You know, we pride ourselves on being unbiased and that we're not connected to you know, we're not an entity of DCFS. We're not tied to any of the agencies that serve. Our funding is not, you know, tied to any kind of numbers or anything like that. So we can go in there and say, Judge, this is what we think needs to happen. And this, you know, maybe this agency can do it or that agency can do it. We also have a really good working relationship with all the agencies. And we talk a lot with them, and we take care of a lot of problems before they ever make it to court, and that's the best way to handle these.
Well, before we get back into volunteers, mm-hmm. you're just talking about other social services.
Mm-hmm.
There was an article in the paper today I showed you just
right.
off the air
mm-hmm.
where the budget is starting to have a terrible effect. The state of Illinois budget, lack of a budget,
right.
let's put it that way,
right.
Is causing social services to have a problem. Are you having the similar kind of problem? I know a lot of it is donations,
right?
But the county has to put in,
mm-hmm.
The state puts in.
Mm-hmm.
Are you hurt by that in any way?
Well, fortunately for us, as far as state money that actually comes directly from the state of Illinois, we have only one grant, which is slightly under $18,000 from the Attorney General's office. They were behind, but as of a couple weeks ago, they're caught up with us. And that's because that money is actually victim witness money.
Right.
So the money comes in from victims and offenders that have to pay fines, and it's required to be collected and required to be distributed. Now, we were a beneficiary of some of the money from the Penn State sanctions that the Big Ten imposed
oh, really?
On Penn State. We were notified in early June that was being eliminated, and that was eliminated 2 years early. And
yeah.
for us, that was about $55,000. So we are trying to recover that money at this point. as far as the state is concerned, the effects that we will see are agencies like Lutheran Social Service that is having to cut drastically.
Well, DCFS is
Is overworked.
He's really hurting over there.
Yeah, they're all overworked. Their caseloads are way too high. So what you're going to see, and I've heard Catholic Charities is starting to talk about having to cut at some point soon. And so what you're going to see is you're going to see kids particularly waiting longer for services not being available. We already know of service providers that don't take state contracts anymore because they can't get paid. And, you know, unfortunately, it boils down to you've got to be able to keep the lights on in your office and you've got to look for something else. But you're gonna start hearing, as we already have, many, many stories about kids in my business, kids that are being underserved. But, you know, as we heard the state of the state budget today and some press conferences after, there's a lot of programs that are looking at closing, not just kids. It's seniors. It's Races is across the hall from us, Rape Crisis Advocacy. They're having to cut staff starting February 1st. So this is a really, really bad situation, to say the least.
Yeah, I have a quote here from Dale. Dale Morrissey is the CEO of the DSC, and he said, care program for the parents of adults and disabilities had to be eliminated last summer because of the loss of about $135,000 in state aid. And in the 40 years I've been in this business, there's never been a greater shortage statewide of employees willing to serve people with disabilities because of their wages are so low.
That's right.
Morrissey said, we've got to get to the message to the governor's office. We need to start doing old-fashioned politics and getting people to the Capitol. Let's take a quick break here. We're at 8:32 p.m. I want to thank Rush Record for coming out. He was up real early this morning on another radio station I will not mention because this radio station takes time and effort to really give you an education, understanding of what we do here at WEFT 90.1 FM and streaming live at WEFT.org. Let's move into a little bit. I know you say they don't need a lot of qualifications, volunteers, but there is a list of qualifications that volunteers need to have. There's certain age requirements.
Right.
Could you give us a list of what the volunteer, so that you don't get inundated from this show by hundreds of volunteers?
Let's hope so. One of the basics is you got to be 21. You have to be 21 or older to do the job, a minimum. We do ask for a two-year commitment to the program, and the reason that is because that's really the average length of time that these cases take.
About two years.
We've got cases that are far longer than that, but it's rare for cases to close a year or less. It's pretty rare to happen. So we ask for a 24-month commitment. Now, having said that, I will also say that I don't want that to keep somebody from talking to us about volunteering. You know, we understand that you may come in today and commit to 2 years, and life happens. You know, people have to move. Unfortunately, there's tragedy and things, but I don't want that to keep somebody from committing to maybe working with us. We really want people to be able to work on their own. One of the most important things is to be able to keep information highly confidential. This is a very unique volunteer opportunity in that you have access to very highly confidential information. And you've got to be able to keep that to yourself. You can't really even go home and talk to your spouse about it. That's just the way it is. We have very high standards when it comes with that. We teach a lot of things like writing, what to look for. These folks will do home visits, which is one of the things that makes people the most nervous.
Tell us a little bit about one. There is a lot of detail, isn't there? Have good handwriting kind of thing, or you use computers.
Yeah, we transfer everything to computers, we teach you a lot of this in training, but nothing replaces being able to observe the child where they're placed.
Right.
And we're actually legally required to see them face to face at certain stages. And so, you gotta be willing to go see them in their homes. And I will tell you that these kids come from all walks of life. So there's no You know, there's no place that we've never been.
You can't profile it. Right.
But, you know, sometimes until you get over that initial hump of who you are and what you're there for, you might have to deal with a little bit of uncertainty as to why this person's in my house. What we do, though, is that once our training is completed and you're sworn in with the judge and you become a CASA, we actually will pair you with a seasoned CASA as a mentor. And that person will help you through that initial stage. So they might go with you on one visit. They might go with you on a couple if you're still nervous about it. They'll help you write that first report. We'll help you get, you know, over that hump. Because we know that even though we're very proud of our training, it's very extensive, there's a lot of information. We know that once you get out, walk out of there, it doesn't mean that you're 100% ready to go. And so we've got a lot of good CASA advocates that have volunteered to do that and help the new people get through that phase of uncertainty.
As you know, experience on the job is different than education in the classroom.
Right.
And so when you send someone out, what they find in the field is not always what they've seen in class.
And again, nothing replaces that. Nothing replaces going to see where they are. Number one, we've got to make sure they're safe. You know, even though they're placed there, there's been occasions when we've done home visits and it wasn't an appropriate placement. May not have been a safe place, may not have been really appropriate for the kids to live there. And so we've uncovered that a lot of times. And then the initial requirement that we really have to stick pretty closely to is that initial training. And as I said, it's about 3.5 weeks. It's three nights a week from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. You really need to be there as much as you can. There are some classes that we can work out. You know, if you've got to miss, there's some classes that we can teach you outside of that class. Then there's some classes we've got presenters coming in that we really can't have you miss. This 30-hour training program is partly National CASA, so it's accredited by National CASA. We're required to do everything they ask us to do in the training, and then we add some local flavor to that. You know, we add, again, what does the court report in Champaign County look like? What are the judges looking for? What can you put in? What can't you put in? You know,
Do you introduce them to the judges?
Judges, we are very fortunate here. Our judges are very active and very supportive. Yeah. So one of our class sessions is a panel, and we bring in a defense attorney. Sometimes it's been a public defender. Sometimes it's been a private attorney. One of the state's attorneys that works on these cases, and one of the judges will come, and they alternate. So it's an opportunity for them to present their role, and it's an opportunity for our volunteers to question them. And so I can tell
also
you.
Also etiquette in a courtroom.
Right.
That people, most people don't realize.
Right. And you know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, I worked in the county for a long time and I came from the probation office, and the probation office has very high standards for their officers as far as what, you know, courtroom demeanor is. And we try to pass that on to our volunteers. What we tell them is, you know, our volunteers may be on one case, but when they're out working, they're representing the whole program and all the kids. But they do have an opportunity to get face-to-face with the judge, get to know them a little bit, ask some questions before they get sworn in. But the most important thing and most important opportunity they have is to submit that information to the court and tell them what they think. And juvenile court is highly confidential. You can't just walk in the courtroom off the street. And so it's a privilege to be there.
It's a private proceeding.
No public. Right.
Right.
It's a private proceeding. And again, it's a privilege to be there. And so to be able to, for Al Kurtz to be able to write a report, say, Judge, this is what I think should happen in this case.
Wow.
That's a very big responsibility.
I was just going to say.
And a privilege.
Yeah.
And that's, I tell our advocates, that's one of the single most important things you can do and the opportunity you have. We do have a section. Our court reports, as you can imagine, have to be highly factual. You know, the information contained in there has to be factual. But we do have a section where they can give their concerns and their opinion. And our advocate coordinator, we vet the reports. I mean, we look at them. We, you know, make sure everything's good to go. But for the most part, they have an opportunity to tell the judge what they think. And the judge reads them. They read all of them. It's not to say that what we say goes, but we do feel like we do feel like they value our opinion very highly. and we're pretty proud of that.
Do they have? Do you go in and observe sometimes, or you have people who observe how a new advocate might be working in a courtroom?
Each CASA advocate is assigned one of our paid advocate coordinators. So we have three and a half advocate coordinators, and their job is to supervise the advocates. So they have a caseload of advocates. And so, yeah, they will – obviously, we have requirements that when it comes time to write a report, we've got a time frame. The report needs to come to us first.
Right.
We look at it. The coordinator looks at it. They go over things. Maybe there's some things that need to be changed. Ultimately, the report comes to me. I look at it. I approve it. Send it over. And then the coordinators may go with them if they're new. But we have well, there is always a CASA representative in every single hearing. So we have volunteers that do what we call court watching. And they will be in every abuse neglect hearing, and they will take notes for us. And then they will bring it back, and then we've got to transfer that and keep track of everything in our cases and our calendar. And, you know, like I said, with 400 cases, there's a lot of information to keep track of. The calendar alone is a pretty daunting process because we've got to make sure that we're in court the next time. We've got to know what the next hearing is. We've got to know what's required. So we have volunteers that do that every day as well.
So we have CASA in Champaign County.
Mm-hmm.
How many other CASAs are there in the state of Illinois?
There's 33 as of today.
Wow, 33.
There's 33.
And run by the county? Oh, I mean individual, by CASA National.
We're all non-profit.
What's the procedure opening a CASA?
Right. The one thing we all have in common in Illinois is we're all nonprofits.
Okay.
So no, while some – McLean County, for instance – their CASA is under an umbrella of a child network. So not only do they have a CASA, they also have a children's advocacy center. The county highly supports them. Their folks are actually county employees, but they're not a county department.
Right.
Everybody else is a nonprofit, from Cook, who is
they must have.
Right.
Excuse me. How many children? I'm just guessing.
Cook,
you have any idea how many
Cook
children?
Cook is a friend of the court model, which is not the guardian ad litem. So they only serve the amount of kids that they have advocates for. But they're serving more than we are.
Wow.
You've got CASAs down south that are one person working out of their basement, one person operation.
Really?
Serving three or four or five kids.
Oh, wow. I hadn't thought of that. It seems hard for one person to be able to handle something. They need a few volunteers too, don't they?
You know, we all started as, you know, we started here in 94 as a grassroots organization with one person and has grown over the course of, you know, 22 years to what we are now. But we have to go through, for lack of a better term, an accreditation process with National CASA every 4 years. We actually just did ours. It's very extensive to be able to use the CASA name. And then we also have an Illinois CASA Association, which actually I'm the central region rep for CASA programs on that board. And their main charge really is to advocate for us. So they're in Springfield. They're lobbying quite a bit in Springfield. When I first went on the CASA board over there, there was, I think, four employees. They were heavily funded by DCFS. And DCFS hit them with about a 40% cut. And so at that point, they were really trying to start more programs throughout the state. And now they're down to 2.5 people. And so they don't have as much time to do that. But, you know, if we have problems or issues, we can call Illinois. We can bounce some things off of them. We can call National. But we all operate independently. I mean, we all do things. We all do things differently. You know, Vermilion County operates different than we do. We operate a little bit different than Coles County does. But right now there's 33. I don't know if there's any talk of any of those programs going away. But when I started 6 years ago, there were 36 CASA programs.
Wow.
So there have been some that
have just
disappeared.
Disappeared.
Yeah.
And the child is left sort of...
They just don't have a CASA advocate. You know, the judges are relying on the professionals.
And you see so many stories in the newspaper about someone for some reason had to go in somebody's home, and I don't think it's prevalent, but the child is in a cage or in a closet, and they have found that this child is undernourished or starving.
I just saw one today. They found a child in a closet, duct taped.
Duct taped?
Yeah. I don't. That wasn't here. I don't remember where that was.
Why do these people have parents? Why are they parents?
You know,
and if they are parents, why don't they just, you know, give their child up for adoption or something?
One of the things that I tell people is it's hard to try to rationalize any of that thinking. To be honest, you know, you and I would never do anything like that. But a lot of it, particularly, I would say the violence part. A lot of times, that's cyclical. You know, that's what the parents maybe learned as kids. Wow. A lot of times, though, and this dealing with kids really in general, a lot of times it's not just one problem. You know, there may be, yes, there's abuse, but there may be alcohol in the picture as well. You know, when I worked truancy caseload, a lot of times, yeah, the kids didn't want to go to school, but many times there was more than that.
Right.
You know, there may have, maybe the kids were working. You know, I had many kids who were old enough to work that were helping support the family, and an education wasn't the priority. Keeping the lights on was a priority. Delinquency is the same way. You know, many times it's several different problems.
It doesn't necessarily mean poverty. It's how you treat the child, mm-hmm. or how you treat any human being.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't always reflect back on finances or
not always,
financial
no.
things. No. Some of these people need help themselves.
Right.
Some of these parents.
That's exactly right. And maybe they never got the help when they were kids, you know, or their parents never got the help, and that's what they know. And, you know, one of the most common questions I get is, do we see a spike in cases around the holidays or, you know, when the economy crashed? Or we don't necessarily see that in court because, again, ours are the most serious cases. But the DCFS hotline does see spikes. Holidays, they'll see spikes. They're going to get more phone calls during the school year than they are in the summertime because school's in session. You got mandated reporters. Kids are out of school in the summer. So it doesn't mean abuse has gone away. It just means that the calls aren't necessarily there. So it's a pretty complicated problem.
Well, I'm sitting here just thinking of this in totality. It's just seems overwhelming at mm-hmm. times. And how many kids really are not able to get into the system to be helped?
There's a lot of kids that we don't ever see. You know, it's difficult, but, you know, we've got to try to focus on the kids that we have, help the kids we have, help them to become productive adults and get them the services and get them out of the system. All these kids need something. You know, they need some kind of help, and that's one of the things that we can provide.
You have certain resources that you use. Could you give us a few
sure.
ideas of what each of these programs do for mm-hmm. you and how they help you?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Attorney General's Office, as I said, they help fund us a little bit. They have a youth advocacy initiative. You know, that the Attorney General's Office is a place that does a lot more than people know about, I think. But they do a lot of funding for some youth programs, some victim programs. They have some programs out there that they work on. As I talked about Illinois CASA, they really provide the leadership for us. If there is, you know, anybody out there that's interested in another county that's interested in starting, Illinois CASA is your first step. They would help you do that to get that off the ground. DCFS does a lot more than just abuse neglect. Adoption, licensing, they do daycare licensing. If you're interested in being a foster parent, you could talk to DCFS. You could talk to Lutheran Social Services. Cunningham Children's Home has their own foster parents. The Center for Youth and Family Solutions, you can call them. They all license at each person individually. The National CASA program is really kind of our national representative. You know, they're active in Congress. National CASA does get some money from the federal government that they distribute to some programs across the country. Again, their charge is to really do advocacy and awareness nationwide for the CASA movement, to talk about what we do and expand what we do. We're funded here by the United Way locally, very strong advocates of the program. We actually just went through the grant process with them, so they're reviewing our grant application that we go through every 2 years. You can donate to the United Way, and money funnels through CASA. But really, they're a they're a great resource for a lot of things in the community, not just kids and abuse neglect. You know, they just opened their homeless shelter, and so the United Way is a great resource
for Champaign
County. Yeah, yeah.
And some of these homeless shelters have families
right.
with children.
Right.
Do you have any dealings with the homeless?
Not unless
unless there's abuse.
Yeah, not unless there's abuse.
There's no help for
you're not going to, unfortunately, you're probably not going to get into court for being homeless. When I came here, 25 years ago now, the numbers of kids in the abuse neglect court actually were higher. But that was back when you could come into abuse neglect court for truancy, for not going to school. You know, a dirty house would be one of the reasons that you can come in. Nowadays, if we see a dirty house, it's going to be a house that is kind of what I say, like the hoarder type on the TV show type of thing.
Oh, wait.
Yeah.
We're going to get to that in a minute because my wife loves that show. Well, my wife is listening to that. Hoarders, you actually have been in homes that are like filled with like what we see on TV.
We hope we haven't been in them because by the time we've been in them, it's been cleaned up. But we've been in a couple that we've asked for some things to happen once we've been in the house. But back 25 years ago, the standard would be much lower than it is now to come to court. And really the reason for that is DCFS has moved to try to not take people to court. They really try to keep them out of the system.
Right.
And I don't know that that's a bad thing, to be honest with you.
Right.
And so that's where they put services into place. You know, they're going to offer cleaning help. And, you know, if you've got a child that's not going to school, they're going to refer you to the regional office. They're going to try to get you some services in place. So now, literally, when we get a case, it's very serious for us to get. It's not often that we get a case that's the very first incidence of
right.
abuse. Many
right.
times there's been many calls before. Unless it's just to a level that is extreme.
Well, we are listening very attentively and really interesting show tonight with Mr. Rush Ricard, who is the executive director of CASA here. It's 8:53 coming up, and we'll be off the air in just a few minutes. You're listening to WEFT 90.1 FM on your radio dial and weft.org streaming live on a global basis, or mostly in the United States, I think.
You never know.
That's Rush. Well, I want to thank Rush. Rush, give us a sense of, you'll take anybody who walks in the door who qualifies.
Who qualifies.
Yes.
And what I would say is, if anybody's thinking about it, at least call us. We're going to be honest with you and talk you through the process. And we'll come to a conclusion mutually. You know, if it's not the right time, we can deal with that. I just don't want somebody to be thinking about it and not follow through, because we really do need your help. So call us.
What's your phone number?
384-9065. You can talk to Jim Wersch. You can talk to Brooke Adams. Talk to me. Check out our website, which is CASA4kids.org. So CASA4kids.org. There's a lot of information on that website. The application is on the website. There's many questions. There's an email address. You can email us if you have questions.
And
we'll talk you through it.
It's a worthy cause and nonprofit. So
right.
if you donate to CASA, it's tax deductible.
Absolutely.
And obviously, with what's going on in the budget and what's going on in our social service area, mm-hmm. Which is very, very difficult, we need to try and offset the budget shortfall that is now taking place and affecting not only children,
right.
but the parents of the children.
Yeah.
And that can be really difficult. So I want to thank Rush for coming in, explaining his background and his name. Does everybody know now how it happened? And how it's a middle name.
It's a middle name.
If I call you Robert, is that going to be trouble?
It won't
or
be
Bob.
Trouble.
Are you a Bob?
It might take a minute for me to realize you're talking
that it
to
was
me.
You.
I'll answer to it.
How did it get to the middle name?
It's always been the middle name.
It's always been the middle
name. I've never been Robert. One of the hardest things for me to do was in school. Because nobody would let me put R. Rush on my transcripts, so I always had to be Robert R. And I would, the first day when they would call out Robert, I would say, would you please call me Rush? And they looked at me like, what? Russ? I said, no.
Rush.
So, yeah, Rush.
That's,
yeah.
You've heard some others who said where your name came from.
But right.
We know it didn't come
it
from
did
him.
It did not. No. No.
No,
and there's
at all.
A slight difference in the bank accounts there, too. So,
yeah, yours is more than his.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Rush, thank you so much
thank
for coming
you.
In. This has been a pleasure. And I want to thank you for your service to our community and to the children of our community. They're the most vulnerable. They're the toughest, you know, kids. You want them to grow up to be good standing citizens
right.
and get a job and get an education and not end up in the sheriff's department.
Right. Exactly.
You know, where we have our juveniles mm-hmm. and but we try to do the best we can with what we have. So, again, thank you very much. And I'm going to take a few minutes here, give you some promotions and the promotional information. And I want to thank Rush for coming in tonight and giving us a really interesting hour. Thank you so much,
thank
Rush.
Thank you, Al. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Take care. Have
all
a
right.
great evening.
Thanks.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we've got a few housekeeping chores to take care of here. Hang on, and we're going to take care of them. WEFT's YouTube channel. Did you know that WEFT has a YouTube channel? We do, and you can check it out at youtube.com, WEFT 90.1 FM, or visit our website at weft.org for a link. We currently have 100 videos from WEFT sessions, videos from fundraisers at the Iron Post, links to the Prairie Monk and view of WEFT from the 1990s when the stations were just over 10 years old. We're adding new videos all the time. Check them out and let us know what you think. I do have a couple of local issues that took place here today that I wanted to talk to you about. Just quickly, we have just about 3 minutes left. As you know, that we're going to have a Central High School and Unit 4 board sharing his views. And once again, looks like they're going to try and find locations for the new Central High School. And there is an opening on the school board. If you're willing to help the community and help our schools and our children as well, why don't you try out for the Unit 4 school board. Also, we had a very interesting situation that has taken place here, a dire situation without a state budget. As we were talking with Rush, I noticed this article from today's Champaign News Gazette. Champaign Rape Crisis Center will close by the end of April without state funding. An adult daycare center no longer provides services one day a week. A local autism program will shut down at the end of May without a budget resolution. The Prairie Center, a substance abuse treatment center, will run out of money in May and may have to go to bank loans to stay open. A respite program that serves 65 local families with disabilities was discontinued last July. Managers of all local social service programs said Thursday that they're pleading with Governor Rauner and state legislators to settle a 7-month budget impasse that has left them without state funding. They spoke at a news conference organized by House Speaker Michael Madigan's staff, where even Madigan came in for criticism. Speaker Madigan and Governor Rauner and those who are not yet on board said Mary Evans, director of the Rape Advocacy Counseling and Education Services of Urbana, we're not asking, we're not pleading, we're humbling ourselves and are begging for you to step up and do the job that people of Illinois elected you to and entrusted you to do. Meet at the table, any table, turn your full attention to the needs of all the citizens of Illinois and focus your energy on crafting and passing a much-needed, long-overdue state budget. The people are tired of our short-term pain for our long-term gain. Evans said the 45-year-old Rape Crisis Center would begin reducing services and staff in about a month and go dark by the end of April. Well, I can't go any far because we're coming to the end of our show. I want to thank you for listening to Big Al's Community Chat. I'll be back on January 27th at 8 p.m. on WEFT 90.1 FM and on weft.org. We are streaming live. Thank you and have a great evening. Thank you.